This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., backed by the trusted voices of Team Fox. Team Fox. A clear, fresh voice cutting through the noise to tell the truth. It's the Guy Benson Show with Guy Benson.
It is Tuesday, April the 9th, 2024. I'm Guy Benson. Welcome to my show, The Guy Benson Show. We're so glad you're here. Every weekday between 3 and 6 p.m. Eastern Time, then around the clock on our podcast, totally free, on demand. Once again, no charge. That's a feature. GuyBensonShow.com is our website. Other options are FoxNewsPodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm political editor at townhall.com. You can read my work there. I am a contributor at Fox News and host of this fine program. Our lineup today starts with KT McFarland later on this hour. She has served under 4 different presidential administrations in foreign policy capacities. We will pick her brain. In the next hour, Sandra Smith, our colleague, with her business acumen, will be talking about the U.S. economy, a few different topics there. And then Andy McCarthy on the law and some legal wrangling in Washington, D.C. So experts galore on the Guy Benson Show here today. I want to begin on this student loan debt, quote-unquote, forgiveness scheme from President Biden, which I think it's quite clear is not only illegal, yet again, but also, as always, extremely unfair. And as long as Biden brings this up, which he's doing quite obviously to try to buy votes from specific, generally younger voters, it is imperative that we point out the lawlessness of what he's trying to do, because he's not going to Congress say, hey, let's do this together, which would be very bad policy for a number of reasons, but it would be legal. He's not doing that. He is flouting the law again. We'll get into that. It's also, as I just mentioned, damaging bad policy for a number of reasons, economically. We'll get into that. And it is deeply, profoundly unfair to the 80 to 87% of American adults who have no student loan debt and yet who are backstopping this scheme, or who would backstop the scheme if it were to go through and be upheld, which my guess would be it won't, because Biden is going to try to just sort of ram this thing through and dare someone to stop him through executive order. And if it goes to the Supreme Court again, if they put a halt to it, he will demagogue them and attack that institution and undermine the legitimacy of the Supreme Court, which is a dangerous, awful thing that Democrats do on the regular. They only care about norms and institutions and democracy and all of that when it suits them. When it gets in the way of their ideological project, then screw that. It's all about power. But if he doesn't get stopped up in court, at least before the election, I think what he'll probably do is say, well, look at all this, quote, relief that millions of people are getting. Are the Republicans really going to turn back the clock and deny these people their relief and take this away from them? It's just so cynical on top of everything else. So Biden went to swing state Wisconsin yesterday. This is, of course, the bellwether of bellwethers, as Josh Krasauer calls it. I'm sure Hillary Clinton was very confused by a Democrat going to Wisconsin. It's something that she never saw fit to do in the general election that she lost in 2016. Biden's people at least have the sense to fly him there from time to time. And he gave a speech in which he was once again saying, well, we got stopped last time in this lawless scheme by the Supreme Court, but that didn't let us, that didn't stop us. Here's cut seven, a little bit of what the president said.
Tens of millions of people's debt was literally about to get canceled. But then some of my Republican friends and elected officials and special interests sued us, and the Supreme Court blocked us. But that didn't, well, that didn't stop us. No, I mean it sincerely. We continue to find alternatives past to reduce student debt payments that are not challengeable. And altogether, my administration has taken the most significant action to provide student debt relief ever in the history of this country. We started by fixing two existing programs to get more people student debt relief than they're, that they were entitled to.
So it is challengeable. It will be challenged. It's still illegal. Notice the demagoguery of those nasty Republicans who sued over the totally illegal thing I was doing, just magically waving a wand that doesn't exist. And the president said, and the debt is canceled. Congratulations, America. Oh, no, a lawsuit? Well, these meanies. Ew, the Supreme Court, look what they did. Boo, says the crowd. This is just, I don't know who falls for this. I can understand if you are in the small group of people who has racked up a bunch of student loan debt and you don't want to pay it back, you would clap like a trained seal to all of this. It doesn't matter how many laws he's breaking or what terrible moral hazard problems arise from this type of policy. But aside from that, it's just like bottom of the barrel, paint by numbers, dumb, ham-fisted pandering to a small number of people while trashing opponents when he was the one trashing the law. And don't just take the conservative Supreme Court's word for it, although they did come down and quite rightly put an end to what he was trying to do. Chief Justice Roberts actually quoted in that correct ruling someone who can't be mistaken for a right-winger. Here in 2021 was Nancy Pelosi, a familiar voice, talking about this very issue and what power Biden does or does not have. The Constitution has not changed since 2021. Cut six.
People think that the President of the United States has the power for debt forgiveness. He does not. He can postpone. He can delay. But he does not have that power. That has to be an act of Congress. So that's not even a discussion.
Not even a discussion.
Not everybody realizes that.
Yeah.
But the president can only postpone, delay, but not forgive.
No. Well, apparently someone who doesn't realize it is the president. They realize it. They don't care. That's the thing. They know that every word from Nancy Pelosi right there is absolutely correct. And that the Supreme Court got it right. They know. They don't care. They want to say to these young people, among whom they are struggling for votes, that's what this is about. He doesn't care about any of the externalities or consequences. He cares about his shaky reelection prospects among his coalition, including young people. That's it. So they understand that Pelosi in the court is correct, and they're just doing this anyway. She said he doesn't have the power to do what now, in round two, he is trying to do. The Supreme Court in that case said, as a matter of fact, yes, Congress would have to take action. If you want to spend taxpayer money this way, it will require the purse strings that originates in the House. It is basic civics, basic constitutional law. But Biden's saying, we're not going to let that stop us. Stupid court. Forget about Pelosi. We're doing it anyway. In a way that's not challengeable. Well, it is going to be challengeable. It's already being challenged. So that's just on the legal side, I think a very disturbing thing where the president of the United States is very egregiously and aggressively saying, we're just going to do this illegal thing because we want to for politics. I think if it were a certain, let's say, former, slightly orange-tinted president, the reaction in the news media, especially if the policy outcome is something that they don't like, I think it would be slightly different about our precious norms and institutions. But when you want to throw all that in the dumpster and light it on fire because it gets you what you want as a leftist and maybe the election outcome that you want, well, I mean, it seems like it's a lot more forgivable, to borrow a term. The Wall Street Journal has a great editorial talking about how this is still quite illegal. And they write in this piece, the High Court, this is in the previous Supreme Court decision, stressed that student loan forgiveness is a major question that requires clear authorization from Congress, which of course Congress has not assented to. Mr. Biden seems to believe he can jam the courts by automatically forgiving debt before a judge has the time to stop him. They ask, where are the press scolds who warn about a president who threatens democracy? And the answer to that question is they are rooting for Joe Biden and will vote for him. That's where they are. So that's the legality piece of it. And it will be challenged, and I think it likely will get struck down yet again, hopefully in time. Here's the other thing, though. Point two that I made at the onset is the policy implication, the moral hazard, and the growth, not just the growth, the explosion of higher education costs. I saw that there are a number of schools now north of $90,000 a year for undergrad. Tufts was like 96 grand in Boston for a year. For one undergraduate year at Tufts, $96,000. The reason it keeps getting higher and higher, there's many reasons, a lot of which deal with government interventions that don't work and just the bloat of bureaucracy, including the whole DEI bureaucracy. There's many reasons. One of the biggest reasons is colleges and universities have no incentive to limit costs because of lawless government bailouts like we're seeing attempted again by Biden. They see that taxpayer backstop. They say, great, let's charge as much as we can. And if some students can't pay it back, we won't be on the hook. They won't be on the hook. We'll just let Uncle Sam, meaning all of us, kind of take care of it. And they shove the problem over onto someone else's plate. So there's no reason for them to say, let's hold down costs or, God forbid, reduce them. Imagine that. It fuels the inflation, the massive inflation of college costs. It makes it much worse. Biden, who's 81, doesn't care about that, of course. It's a problem for young people. It's a systemic problem in our higher education. He's 81, doesn't give a flying you-know-what about that. He does care about whether he can buy off just enough people to vote for him so he can win 6.5, 7 months from now. That is pathetic, and I think it's really, really dangerous. It should be called out not just by conservatives. And then point three is the fairness point. And I think this is an important one to make repeatedly because the Democrats and the left, they like to feel like they own the word fairness. They talk in these moral tones about fairness all the time, often, I think, abusing the term on taxes and the like. But if they're so fixated on fairness, and if they feel like we shouldn't be helping the wealthy, especially at the expense of less affluent or less privileged people, and by the way, the affluent is now their base, right? They are absolutely no longer the party of working Americans. That's long gone. So in some ways, it makes sense that they are pursuing policies that like help white-collar, richer people, because that's increasingly their base. But on the fairness question, how is it fair if 80 to 87%, and I'm using the range because the Democrats will sort of nitpick whether it's exactly 87%, and there's some conflicting arguments over what the exact number is. So let's just say north of 80%, the vast, vast, vast majority of the American public, adults in this country, 80-plus percent of them have $0 and 0 cents of education-related debt, student loan debt. None. They have none. The reason why is the majority of American adults did not graduate from college. They don't have a college degree. They didn't go to college. That's the majority of Americans. They don't have student loan debt because they didn't need it because they didn't go to college. Why should they be on the hook in any way financially for loan so-called forgiveness or cancellation courtesy of taxpayers decreed by a president on behalf of people who signed contracts knowing full well, okay, it's a student loan, it's for me, it's for my future, I'm making this investment, I agree to pay back X, Y, and Z. It's not a trick. It's how loans work. Why should those people be rewarded and then bailed out by people who didn't go to college at all? Or another category of people, people who may have wanted to go to an expensive college, even gotten into an expensive college, but made the adult responsible decision not to go because they couldn't afford it. Our friend Kat Timpf talks about this. She got into her dream school, Columbia Journalism, as a graduate program. She realized she couldn't afford it, didn't want to take on the debt, and she didn't go there. She denied herself what she had dreamed of to be a responsible adult financially. Why should people like that be punished, bailing out people who now decide they don't want to pay back the student loans that they agreed to in a binding contract, willfully, eyes wide open? Then there are the people whose parents or grandparents saved so they could go to school. A lot of hard work was put into that. The money was socked away, not spent on vacations or anything else, saved for those kids or for those grandkids, so they didn't have to take on debt. Did those decisions blow up in grandparents' faces because, hey, now Uncle Joe's out there like Santa Claus and the King just giving away student loan forgiveness? What does that say about personal responsibility? And then, of course, the people who went to college, accrued debt, and then paid off the loans for years, like producer Christine on this show. Why on earth should those hardworking people who did the right thing again be on the hook so Joe Biden can buy some votes? And it's not like stealing from 50% to give to the other 50%. This is an 80-20 or an 87-13% issue. They're just hoping that the people getting screwed, the victims of clear unfairness, aren't as mad as the grateful, forgiven, quote-unquote, 13% of young people are. That's the calculation. And I hope it's the wrong calculation. And the only way it can be driven home as the wrong calculation is through elections for people to vote. So if this seems fair and good to you, by all means, re-elect this crowd for more of these schemes. If not, November is coming. It's the Guy Benson Show. We'll be right back.
Always fresh, always fair. The Guy Benson Show.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
I'm Guy Benson, and right on cue from our opening monologue, we bring you a Fox News alert. State of Florida and five other states have now filed suit already to block and challenge this latest Biden scheme on student loan forgiveness, quote-unquote, forcing other people to pay for others' loans that they didn't take on themselves. So we wish them well in that endeavor, and I would guess that if passes prologue, they will succeed again. Hopefully it gets to the Supreme Court quickly and this can be stopped before Biden just starts doing it willy-nilly. By the way, the White House Twitter feed, the official feed, the White House, responded like dunking on a Republican congressman who is critical of this policy, pointing out that his business received loan forgiveness from PPP, the COVID Paycheck Protection loans, which had forgiveness built into them. The government shut down people's businesses. They weren't allowed to operate during a pandemic. They said, here's loans to pay your people so they don't lose their jobs. And if you do that, you can get it forgiven. It bears no resemblance to student loans. They must think we're idiots. Many of us are not.
America is listening to The Guy Benson Show.
We're back. It's The Guy Benson Show. I'm so glad that you are listening. Honored. Thank you. GuyBensonShow.com. Podcast is always free. And we are privileged to once again speak with Katie McFarland. She is the former Trump Deputy National Security Advisor. She has worked for four Republican presidents in their administrations. She is author of the book Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. KT, great to hear your voice.
Well, it's really an honor and a pleasure to be with you, too. Thank you, Guy.
I just want to get your analysis. You've been with Nixon, Ford, Reagan, Trump, four very different men with, in some respects, very different foreign policies. They probably agreed on certain major principles. As you look at the current president and the hash that he is making of his Israel policy, where it really feels like in the last few weeks in particular, he has taken a turn that has deliberately or otherwise been extremely helpful to Hamas and has really hampered Israel. What are you seeing? What is your analysis of this?
Well, why is he doing it? Okay, so I totally agree with what you've just said, but why is he doing it? It's not what's best for America, what's best for Israel, what's best for peace in the Middle East. It's what's best for Joe Biden at the polls. You know, how is Joe Biden going to get reelected? And it all boils down to 20,000-30,000 voters in Dearborn, Michigan. Biden needs to win Michigan to win the presidency. And to win Michigan, he probably needs those Muslim American voters. So he's basically suborning American policy towards Israel, one of our closest allies in the world and one of the mainstays of our alliances in the Middle East. And he's basically taking their foreign policy and putting it in the hands of people who are standing in the streets of Dearborn, Michigan, chanting death to America.
Yeah, let's
Those
listen.
Are the guys determining our foreign policy towards Israel.
Let's listen to that. This was from that Dearborn rally. This was one of these pro-Hamas hate rallies. And it was just a few days ago. Death to America chants in Michigan, in Dearborn, Michigan. This is the community that Biden is pandering to. He wants their votes. Cut 28.
And this is why Imam Khomeini, who declared the International Day of Quds, this is why he would say to pour all of your chants and all of your shouts upon the head of America.
So death to America, you're hearing there in Arabic, and the quote that he is, the person he's quoting, as you know, is the Ayatollah, the supreme leader of the revolution in Iran. I mean, one of the most grotesquely anti-American, anti-Semitic, anti-Israel leaders in modern world history. And he's being favorably quoted by this rabble-rouser at this Dearborn rally, which then triggers these death to America chants. I'm not sure if Joe Biden is going to win those particular chanters' votes. I don't know. I'd love to see if the White House gets asked about death to America chants, if they're willing to even condemn those, or if we'll get some sort of word salad from Karine Jean-Pierre. But there are a lot of friends and neighbors and sympathizers who may not quite go as far as screaming death to America in America, but it's like pins and needles for the political operation, KT, of this administration and this president. They don't want to further alienate that crowd. I mean, if that's what you're relying on to win an election, it's kind of a scary thing.
It's a terrifying thing. But when you think of President Biden's policies, it's all about when it's, again, it's not what's best for America. It's not what's best for the people in the Middle East. It's not how to bring peace and prosperity to the world. It's all about getting Joe Biden elected. I mean, he's pandering to college students. I'm going to forgive all of your loans. You're not even going to have to pay college tuition if you vote for me. And he's really just selling America into a very strange place. It's hard for me to even put words into the damage, the long-range damage he's going to do to the country. I mean, leaving an open border, 10 million people coming in. Why is he doing that? It's very deliberate. They want to get 10 million people into the United States, give them benefits, and then give them citizenship.
Yeah.
So that they'll vote for Democrats, and then Democrats can be permanently in power. Who cares if it's best for the country? It's just best for some people who just are so grasping for power that I don't know how they live with themselves, frankly.
What's interesting, KT, is on that note, since you mentioned the border and Hispanic voters, there is a new Axios poll that shows Joe Biden's standing among Latino voters in this country has fallen precipitously. In a head-to-head, he's barely leading. He's basically tied with Donald Trump among Hispanic voters. And within the issues, Hispanic voters trust Trump on immigration significantly more than Biden. So I know that maybe they feel like all of these sops and these racial panders to certain groups will work for them. Maybe it won't work the way they're expecting. Maybe that's at least partially my hope if you look at the data. But obviously they are making these decisions for various reasons, and I think a lot of it absolutely, undeniably, is calculated in the way that you point out. Before I move on, I just want to – I think this is an important question to ask, especially someone of your knowledge and who has so much experience. When you talk about the importance – and when we talk about the importance of the U.S.-Israeli alliance and that relationship – there might be some people who say, okay, great, we talk about Israel as an ally, and certainly we have been an ally to them. We've been very helpful to them. We've armed them. We've given them aid. We've sold them lots of weapons. But maybe it's a one-way relationship. Maybe the alliance is really valuable to them, existentially valuable to them, but maybe it's not so important or that valuable to us. From an America First perspective, KT, why is the Israeli alliance really crucial to us on our side?
Well, it's for what we stand for. Israel's a democracy. But frankly, Israel's keeping peace in the Middle East, you know, in a weird way. Why? Why do I say that? Because if Israel ceased to exist, disappeared tomorrow off the face of the earth, well, who's in charge of the Middle East? Iran is in charge of the Middle East. Iran, who the Biden administration has enriched because of Biden's policies, not only of pandering to Iran, but not enforcing the sanctions. He's allowing Iran to sell oil. Trump didn't allow them to sell oil. Biden has arranged for Iran to have billions of dollars worth of revenues that Trump had frozen. And then particularly because of Biden's energy policies, which drives the price of oil sky high, that enriches Iran. Iran, what is Iran doing with this probably $100 billion that Biden has let them have? They're making war. And they're not going to stop until they control the entire Middle East. So from an America First, what's in it for us? How are we affected? I think American national security is in danger if you have Iran in the Middle East, in charge of the Middle East, and a nuclear Iran in the Middle East. So in a roundabout way, now maybe it's not Iran isn't going to fire those missiles at the United States, but anybody who's chanting death to America, you know, believe dictators. One thing I've learned in 50 years in this line of work, don't believe politicians. They'll tell you anything, right? They need to get elected. Look at Joe Biden. Believe the dictators because they don't care about public opinion. They're telling you right straight to your face what they're intending to do. Mm. And death to America is Iran's policy.
Yeah, that's such an important point. I would also note on that point, the Israelis have done so much militarily, but also through intelligence and some really dramatic intelligence coups. They've been able to set back the Iranian regime and their nuclear program on numerous occasions, stealing a bunch of their documents in a brazen, amazing raid that they pulled off, the Stuxnet bug that they were able to use to infect the nuclear program in Iran, some certain bombings, and there was, of course, a targeted strike against an Iranian leader in Syria not long ago. Was that last week? The Israelis, maybe that's a roundabout way of saying the Israelis do some of the really tough, sort of dirty hands stuff that the U.S. doesn't want to. They do a lot of intelligence sharing with us. That's another big, big, big plus for the U.S. and vice versa. And we say, hey, Israel, here's some intelligence from our end. That looks like a threat to us and probably to you. I wish someone could do something about that. And often it's the Israelis doing it. So it's not us and our people and our boots. if I'm not mistaken, KT, that's at least part of my characterization, augmenting your explanation of why I think people underestimate the Israeli side of this alliance at their peril.
Israel is helping the United States because Israel, at least prior to what's happening now, was keeping the peace in the Middle East. And the Middle East, because of its location, because of its population, because of its access to oil, is an important part of the world economy. Mm-hmm. Look, I think that if the United States, if President Trump on day one, he said, I'm going to close the American southern border, and I'm going to drill, baby, drill. I'm going to drive the price of oil down. I'm going to bankrupt Iran. I'm going to bankrupt Russia. And it's a very different world. And until we can get President Trump in office to do those things, I think Israel is holding the line against an Iran which wants to expand not just into the Middle East, but in the entire region, and then dominate it and have worldwide revolution while they're chanting death to America and potentially death to America with their hands on nuclear weapons.
Yeah, and we're not the only ones concerned about a nuclear Iran, an ascendant Iran, a dominant in the region Iran. It's not just the Israelis either. It's a bunch of the Arab Gulf states, which is why you have Israel, at least until recently, making peace with a bunch of those countries under Trump and the Abraham Accords. And there's still hope that maybe Saudi will also get involved in this. They're not just doing it out of the goodness of their hearts and suddenly they love Israel and the Jewish state, but it's a, you know, enemy of the enemy situation, Iran being the common enemy. And it just feels like so much of the progress that was being made recently has been undermined and undone. And of course, Iran had fingerprints all over October 7th, hoping to drive further wedges in our country between the U.S. and Israel, between the Arab Gulf states and Israel. And it seems like Biden is just blundering directly into that Iranian trap on purpose for this political, short-sighted, I think, dangerous mentality that you're talking about. And now we learn, and KT, this is very sad news, but in the last day or so, it's being reported that the Hamas negotiators, quote unquote, they've rejected all these ceasefires. They've rejected all of these deals, no matter how generous, very actually characteristic of Palestinians generally over decades. But now they seem to be saying, well, a lot of these hostages that we've been using as very valuable bargaining chips, well, they might not be alive after all. So it seems, I know, shock of all shocks, KT, Hamas might have been lying about the number of living hostages. They haven't allowed any verification, International Red Cross, nothing like that. So it feels like the Israelis, under pressure from our administration, have been negotiating against themselves, played for fools, even though I think they have a pretty clear-eyed view of this. When you've got Biden breathing down their neck saying, don't do this, you can't do that, they're handcuffed by the American administration. And in a war against Hamas, why on earth would we do that?
The problem is that President Biden and all the things he's forcing Israel to do and all the speeches he's made, does he talk about American hostages? You know, they're American citizens who were held hostage.
Yep.
So when he's talking about aid to the Palestinians, he's building ports and bridges. What is he getting for that? He's not even getting information about the Americans who are being held hostage. To me, the fundamental thing a president needs to do is to protect the American people. And if he's not going to even bother to stand up for American citizens being held hostage, then really, I mean, I guess it is the America Last foreign policy, as long as it's the Joe Biden first.
I interviewed the parents yesterday of one of those American hostages, a 23-year-old who's been held since October 7th. He was at the music festival. He was wounded and then taken to Gaza. His parents were on Fox and Friends. I interviewed them on set. I don't think, correct me if I'm wrong, KT, I don't think Joe Biden has said the name of any of those American hostages in any of his public pronouncements. And recently it's been like nothing about the hostages at all, or October 7th. It's all Israel, Israel, Israel. All the pressure going that direction is how it feels.
You know, I guess it's more important for him to get the votes in Dearborn, Michigan, from people chanting death to America, than it is to protect the American people and the American citizens who are being held. Every president that I've worked for, every president in my, and, you know, going back to Lincoln, they've always protected Americans. They've They've always tried to look out for an American citizen being taken. I mean, Ronald Reagan, Donald Trump, can you imagine if they would say, if you harm a hair on the head of an American citizen, we're coming to get you. And yet, Joe Biden, it's just not convenient for him to talk about American citizens who are being held hostage. And we know from the people who are coming out that not only are they being held hostage, horrible things is happening to these people. Horrible, unspeakable things.
Yep. And now, unfortunately, it appears, as I mentioned, KT, a good number of them are dead. That's at least the strong implication of some of these recent updates. And your heart just breaks for the families who are now wondering, okay, how many are still alive? Is our loved one still alive? And to be an American, knowing that you have an American citizen family member being held by Hamas and the president is putting pressure on the other side of the war and never mentioning your kid or your brother or your friend, it has to be it's beyond maddening. And yet it's this backwards world that we're living in this moment right now. It's distressing. And I'm just very grateful for KT McFarland taking some time and breaking it down with us on the Guy Benson Show on this Tuesday. KT, as always, we appreciate it. We look forward to next time.
Thank you so much, Guy.
We'll take a quick break. Back after this, it is the Guy Benson Show.
A fresh perspective on the topics of the day. It's Guy Benson.
Welcome back to the Guy Benson Show. Just one more thought on the conversation we just had with KT McFarland. She brought up these Death to America chants, which we're used to hearing in Tehran, and maybe out in the Arab street in certain places as they burn our flag. It's a little more grating and shocking when it's being recited, the call and then the response, death to America, in Michigan, USA. Now, a number of weeks ago, the Wall Street Journal published an op-ed that referred to that city, Dearborn, Michigan, as America's jihad capital. Right, that was in the headline of the Wall Street Journal piece. And you had Democrat politicians coming out of the woodwork, tripping over each other to condemn that phrase, to condemn the op-ed, to condemn the Wall Street Journal for even publishing such a hateful, bigoted column. The president of the United States got involved, attacking the piece, criticizing the Wall Street Journal. Islamophobia, bigotry, hate, all of that. Gretchen Whitmer, excuse me, I misspoke. That was not me making a joke. Gretchen Whitmer, the governor of Michigan, also came out, guns blazing, indignant. Now, whether you agree with every word in the op-ed, whether you think that the provocative title, America's Jihad Capital, is unfairly broad-based and smearing a community, we can have that conversation, we can debate it, but it just so happens that there was a pro-jihad rally that just happened in Dearborn, Michigan, where the people at the rally chanted death to America. Seems like at least to some extent it vindicates at least part of the point being made in that op-ed. And if people were so offended and aggrieved by the suggestion in that op-ed title, where are those voices calling out the death to America chants? Any word from Biden or Whitmer on that? No? Oh, how strange.
A new generation of conservative talk. Right here, right now. Fair, fun, and backed by the trusted voices and reporting resources of Fox News. Fox News. You're listening to The Guy Benson Show. And now, here's your host, Guy Benson.
It's a fresh hour of The Guy Benson Show. Thanks for tuning in. GuyBensonShow.com, podcast always free. And we open our middle hour, as usual, with a Fox News alert. The Dow basically flat today, down 9 points at the close, finishing up at 38,883. Market update brought to you by Americans for Prosperity and their mission of timeless principles, expanding freedom, expanding opportunity for every American. Join the largest grassroots group in America. You can go to AmericansForProsperity.org/Guy, G-U-Y, and you can find an AFP chapter near you. Let's bring in our colleague and friend, Sandra Smith, co-anchor of America Reports, alongside John Roberts, every weekday, 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern on Fox News Channel. Sandra, it's always good to talk to you.
Hi, Guy. I'm so happy to be back. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, of course. I want to get your reaction. I opened the show today with a big monologue about really inveighing against Joe Biden's latest scheme on student loan, quote-unquote, forgiveness, and just how it's bad policy, how I don't think it's legal, and how on top of everything else, it's really unfair. From an economic perspective, I wonder how you see this. I think we know what he's doing for political reasons, but if you just strip away the politics, just analyzing what he's trying to do in a vacuum, what do you think of it?
Well, as I woke up this morning and I saw the headlines, Guy, you'll appreciate this. The first thing I started thinking of was, and even the Wall Street Journal was doing this, calling it forgiveness. It's not forgiveness. It doesn't.
Right.
It's not forgiven, and it's not erased, and it's not. It's not, you know, deleted or whatever. Some of these headlines just drove me canceled. It's just not the case. It's a transfer of debt, and the debt is transferred away from those who agreed to take on the loan at mm-hmm. some point in their life. And it is transferred in most cases to those without taxpayers who do not have a college degree and probably will never get one. And they're ultimately paying the price for this. And I think it's sort of reminiscent of the 2008 financial crisis when you saw the American taxpayer bailout of the big banks, right? They took on risky assets that they ended up not being able to bail themselves out of. So the American people had to step in to save the American financial system. However, what is different this time, Guy, is there is no effort on the part of the administration forgiving this debt to curtail the behavior that got us here in the first
place. No, it would encourage it, a lot more of it.
100%. So where is the addressing of those who took out the loans who couldn't afford it or didn't take on an education that would be able to pay it off? Or how about we address the lenders? How about the lenders who issued these loans to people without enough information to know if they would ever be able to pay them off? So I think these are really important questions that we should all be asking, as we do see the politics and the timing of this is pretty obvious. Is this a one-off scenario? Or are there plans to just do this every year?
Yeah, great question. The other thing I want to address on this front before we move on, and I briefly got to it in the last hour as well, one of the talking points, and I mean, it just feels like it's brain dead talking point from the White House, but I get why they're doing it, because it's like, oh, well, look at these hypocrites. They support some loan forgiveness, but not for these students. When Republicans object and conservatives object to this bailout, this scheme, the White House is saying, well, look at these businesses that got their loans forgiven from PPP during the pandemic shutdown and the Paycheck Protection Program. And look, I know that there was a lot of abuse in that program. I think people who fraudulently manipulated that program to get money they shouldn't have gotten, they should be punished, no question about it. It was also a massive global emergency, Sandra, where the government forced businesses to shut down and cease operating as they typically do. And the way, correct me if I'm wrong, the way that the loans were structured, they said if you use X percent of these PPP loans to make sure your employees don't become unemployed, creating a massive disaster in the economy, then you can get these loans forgiven. It was built into the structure of it from the beginning. And they're saying, well, we forgave all these loans for PPP, so it's hypocritical. That was the Republicans agreed to that, but now they won't forgive these loans for students? On a very stupid, superficial level, some people might be, I don't know, persuaded by that. But, I mean, apples and oranges, it's like apples and watermelons here.
All I know is the American taxpayer is on the hook for this. And, you know, I had a chat with Charles Payne about this earlier. You know, you can tie this all in with what we're hearing from Jamie Dimon, sort of warning that if we don't if we don't address our spending habits in this country, this inflationary crisis is going to get worse, and it's going to become a major global economic problem bigger than it already is. I mean, he's warning that we can see an environment like World War II again economically in this country, and a lot of what he is saying, he's pinning it on our out-of-control spending. So as the Wall Street Journal, I think, put it this morning, you know, King Joseph showed them on Monday by waving his royal scepter again, canceling debt for some 30 million borrowers. You know, they might as well be upfront about this. I used this analogy earlier. I was thinking about it. You know how sometimes you go to the store these days and they say, would you like to donate a dollar to such and such organization?
Right.
If you say yes, that's not donated in your name, right? The company's donating a bulk sum in their name.
Right.
And I'm thinking to myself, the American taxpayer, the hardworking plumber or carpenter or whatever it might be, they're not even getting credit for it. They're
Lenders. Yeah, and in this case, it's like the gender studies graduate student from Oberlin. It's not even hungry kids. It's like a far less worthy cause in a lot of cases. And I'm sure the graduate studies, you know, gender studies person from Oberlin would love to have his or her or their, you know, loans, quote unquote, forgiven. But that person made a choice to sign up, put the name on the dotted line of a contract and say, you will lend me this amount. I will pay it back. There's this amount of interest. And over a period of X number of years, I think this degree is going to be worth it to me and I will pay you back. That was the agreement. And to say, oh, wait, sorry, it doesn't matter anymore. And all you people, majority of you who didn't go to college, or paid back your loans, or your parents and grandparents saved so you didn't need loans, or denied yourself your dream school because you couldn't take on that kind of debt, all of you chumps are going to subsidize this magical forgiveness. I mean,
remember that moment. We played it on our show today. Remember that hardworking dad who approached Liz Warren. It was 2020, I think, right?
Yep.
Approached Liz Warren with her debt forgiveness plan, college, you know, loan forgiveness plan. He said, I just paid off my daughter's student loans and worked my tail off doing it. What about me? What do I get?
Yeah, he's like, yeah, do I get a reimbursement for that? She's like, no.
No, no. And like, nothing for all those folks out there. But it's just further proof we're not learning our lessons. And Guy, I do think that I think Democrats could get a little bit more backing if they had any suggestion at all about curtailing this risky behavior and stemming the loans coming from these lenders who are getting these Americans into this position in the first place.
Yeah, no. And in fact, the problem is, as you've alluded to, not only are they not doing that, we are encouraging bad behavior and we are discouraging and punishing good behavior. It is like the sign of a broken society when we see that kind of thing happening over and over again. Sandra, one thing, I know you've seen this. We've been playing the clip. It's definitely intriguing. David Axelrod, extremely smart political operative, whether you agree with him or not on issues. He helped get Barack Obama elected twice. He knows what he's talking about in terms of kind of political instincts in a lot of ways. He was on a podcast, and he is very alarmed by Biden's propensity and the White House's propensity and the Biden campaign's sort of pattern of bragging and bragging and bragging about the economy. Here's what he said in Cut 13.
I wouldn't go out there and extol the miracle of the Biden economy. It just drives me crazy when he does that.
And the reason being, people aren't feeling it. And Sandra, you know, some of the big ticket numbers in the economy are really good right now. Some of them are not so good right now. And there's a lot of underlying concern about where things are going. The answer to that from the White House and the president has been, you ingrates. This economy is the best in the world. We're cooking with gas. Look at these numbers, but not these. But look at these numbers, and the Bidenomics is working, and wow, you should be happy. And Axelrod is saying, let's tap the brakes pretty hard on that messaging because it's going to really piss people off, Sandra.
especially when they tout the strong job numbers, when you really look into it, a lot of the data reveals some concerning things. Larry Kudlow and I were digging through the numbers, and you've got more part-time workers. Mm-hmm. You've got more people taking on two or more jobs. You have more than half the population that can't afford a $500 emergency. You've got even greater numbers of Americans who say that they're living paycheck to paycheck. They've depleted their savings. So when you go out and tout those headline numbers that, say, for example, the Federal Reserve looks at to determine whether there's inflation or should they lower interest rates, that's the difference in what people are feeling. And so for David Axelrod to say what everybody's thinking out loud, I mean, it does drive us nuts. It does, because poll after poll all through the primary season, as you saw, Guy, and our Fox News voter analysis still says people are worried about the future and they're worried about their family's financial circumstance.
Well, and
that has not gone away.
And new headline today from Fox Business, small business optimism has hit its lowest level in 12 years. And the people who run these small businesses, that's the engine of the U.S. economy. These are small business people, employers. They look at inflation and interest rates and labor challenges and the current situation, and their optimism is down. It's hit more than a decade nadir. They're not weirdo, ingrate right-wingers who are just mad at Biden for no reason. They see what they're seeing on the ground. I think that's another red flag here. Sandra Smith, America Reports, 1 to 3, Eastern weekdays on Fox News Channel. Sandra, thank you.
Thanks for having me, Guy.
We'll be right back. I'm Guy Benson. We're back. A Politico story I saw yesterday has a headline about Senator Elizabeth Warren, the racial fraud and hardcore leftist. And in fact, I actually have a thought about Elizabeth Warren and how she might help resolve a conflict in her home state that we'll be talking about in mere moments. Woke Tales is next, and it is a doozy. It's one for the ages. I'll explain. But first, to her great shame, this Politico story explains how Warren says she believes Israel's war in Gaza will legally be considered a genocide. And the genocide smear, the genocide lie, is despicable. It's despicable from Hamas and its supporters. It's despicable from hardcore leftists, anti-American agitators, and Islamists. It is particularly disgusting from a member of the United States Congress. We've seen it from the likes of Rashida Tlaib, but it's starting to infect other people within that party, including now Warren. There's something of a competition, it would appear, among Senate Democrats to figure out who can stake out the most anti-Israel, effectively Hamas-sympathetic position in the upper chamber, and I think Warren may have just taken the lead by dabbling in the genocide talking point. As we've talked about on this show, and we read at length from a Newsweek analysis written by one of the foremost experts in the world on urban warfare, who teaches at West Point and served himself. This is his area of expertise. I know Warren pretends to value expertise, only when the expertise aligns with her ideology, of course. But this man explained in great detail how Israel actually has set a new standard of minimizing civilian casualties, which is really hard when the enemy, Hamas, embeds itself intentionally within civilian infrastructure. They make it as difficult as possible for Israel to do their job in defeating them by saying, we're going to operate our terrorism out of mosques and schools and hospitals and neighborhoods. They do this on purpose. Israel does everything and more within its power to still cut down on civilian casualties, which is by definition the exact opposite of what a genocide is. If Israel, let me say this very clearly, if Israel wanted to commit genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza, they absolutely could. And the death toll would not look anything like approximately 30,000, with a large percentage of that number furnished by Hamas, by the way, 32,000. Hamas number, Israel says close to half of those killed in Gaza are Hamas. The number would be hundreds of thousands. Israel could have just carpet-bombed the Gaza Strip, flattened the place, killed hundreds of thousands, if not millions. That would be genocide. Israel has the power militarily to do it. They haven't done anything remotely approaching that. They have done the opposite. So to see anyone repeat the genocide claim, I think, is really bad. And here's a U.S. senator at least playing footsie with it. I'm sure she'll say, well, we're just talking about certain legal definitions. It is not in the zip code. It is not in the ballpark of genocide. It's the opposite. The genocidal party, very explicitly, in this war is Hamas. And indulging really problematic, disturbing fantasies otherwise is, I just think, unforgivable. Now, Jared Moskowitz is a Florida congressman. He's a Democrat. He responded to this story about Elizabeth Warren, and he asked, is she auditioning to be the president of Harvard? Which is a pretty good line. Harvard's president, of course, was ousted for the anti-Semitism problem and also plagiarism. We know that Elizabeth Warren maybe didn't plagiarize, but she fabricated an entire racial minority status that she used for her own personal professional benefit for many years as an adult, claiming baselessly to be a Native American until she got tenure at Harvard. It's her alma mater. She got tenure at Harvard Law, and then she stopped pretending to be a Native American. She eventually got called out and became so embarrassing for her, she probably wishes that whole thing went away, except if she's maybe in the running to be Harvard president, she can say, look, I can absolutely pander to the genocide crowd. Look at this Politico story. If one of the requirements is to make things up, whether through plagiarism or racial fabulism, I'm your gal. And if you want to replace one female of color with another, hey, I can start checking the box and be Native American again. So maybe Congressman Moskowitz is onto something. We will move on to a different story out of the state of Massachusetts when we come back. It's a woke tales that you don't want to miss straight ahead.
Miss a minute, miss a lot. The Guy Benson Show.
Just past halftime on The Guy Benson Show on this Tuesday, back in D.C. Thanks for tuning in. Time now for a particularly delicious edition of Woke Tales.
Woke Tales, woo!
You might remember, gosh, months ago. It was last year, I think. There was a long story at The Intercept that we read at length here on the show. It was a Woke Tales segment. And the piece chronicled how left-wing activist organizations in Washington, D.C., in the political space, had been paralyzed by internal dissent, infighting, recriminations, accusations, and a lot of it was around race and identity, where you had sort of the professional left consuming itself with these totally unhinged power play maneuvers that had been incentivized and indulged for years, really. And finally, it was coming to a head where even some of previously the most well-funded and effective left-wing organizations in D.C., they were ground to a halt. Their work basically stopped because everyone was busy accusing each other of being something-ist. And it was hilarious because they deserve all of what they're getting. So I devoted multiple segments to just reading from that piece. There's now a similar one. I'm going to call this the feel-good story of the week, maybe the month. And it comes from a very left-wing town in Massachusetts, Amherst, Massachusetts. And this time it's not The Intercept that's writing about this giant woke conflagration. It is The New Yorker. And here is the headline of this piece. There's one caveat, which is overall, I find this delectable and satisfying. Blue on blue thought crime. It's just fabulous. And this is what they have wrought for themselves. They richly deserve all of it. The one hesitation, the one sadness, is this involves a middle school. Now, it's the adults fighting at the middle school, but there are kids involved, and I just feel awful for the adolescent, preteens. That is a hard time in life to begin with. I remember middle school, seventh grade. It's just rough. Everyone's bodies are changing, the hormones, people are mean to each other, people are extra self-conscious. This was even before the age of social media and smartphones. So it's tough out there to be a middle school student. I can only imagine that it's almost impossible to become a happy, normal, productive, well-adjusted young person when you are surrounded by basically an insane asylum of a community of the adults that are addicted to this twisted religion of wokeness. I don't know what else to call it. So I feel bad for the kids. The adults, well, this is the bed that they made for themselves. Headline on the New Yorker story, it just came out a few days ago, the meltdown at a middle school in a liberal town. Subheadline, a post-pandemic fight about racism, the respectful treatment of trans kids, and the role of teachers' unions has divided Amherst, Massachusetts. Oh, there are villains all over the place in this story, and they are all firing rhetorical bullets at each other constantly. So the story begins by setting the scene of what Amherst is like. Western Massachusetts, a nexus of four liberal arts colleges and a major public university, home to 40,000 people. On its woodsy, winding residential streets, the story says, Black Lives Matter and In This House signs sprout alongside native gardens of holly, bayberry, and mountain laurel. In the 2020 election, more than 90% of the town's voters went for Joe Biden. So it's as blue as it gets. 90-plus percent for Biden. I bet you some left-wingers went even farther left than Biden. The Trump vote, virtually non-existent in Amherst, Massachusetts. But then came the wars around Amherst Regional Middle School, and they have been vociferous, the story explains. How and when they started depends on whom you ask, but they broke into wider public view last May when Amherst High School newspaper, The Graphic, published a 5,000-word article headlined, It's Life or Death, Failure to Protect Trans Kids at the Middle School, a Systemic Problem. The piece anonymously quoted several trans and gender nonconforming students, these are middle schoolers, by the way, who recounted numerous incidents of bullying and harassment and, quote, harmful encounters with guidance counselors and other school officials. Okay, so it's an expose by the high school paper. Those kids obviously angling for some sort of Pulitzer Prize at the high school level. Probably an immediate pass to go work at the New York Times. You write a big story on transphobia at a middle school. I mean, you're destined to be a leading light in today's newsroom culture. And so the whole town basically explodes over this high school newspaper article. Now, what's interesting is, within the article, there were details, including that during a prayer meeting at the school, and I'm surprised that those are allowed, frankly, a guidance counselor reportedly said, in the name of Jesus, we bind that LGBTQ gay demon that wants to confuse our children. That was the allegation against a guidance counselor at the school. Now, the counselor denied that this was said. As this whole fight emerged between certain officials at the school and the trans community and parents concerned about gender identity and all of that, well, it got very ugly because there were racial components. The story says an uncomfortable fact was that most of the concerned parents were white and the counselors under scrutiny were not. One of them is Latino, one of them is black. And there's also a black district head of DEI involved here. Superintendent in question, white. So there was a school committee meeting that then lasted 6 hours where people were just going off. And you had all these parents, white people predominantly, yelling and screaming about the maltreatment and harm done to trans students. Can you imagine this in a Biden 90-plus town? Oh, this is some cauldron of transphobic hatred. That's the allegation, apparently. But then one of the defenders of the administration and the administrators in question got up and said this is all, quote, a prime example of how women of color get treated in leadership positions. And this person said the trouble at the middle school is not about LGBTQ+, but rather the product of an unusually combative teachers union and just plain old racism. So, obviously, this has gotten juicy. The New Yorker story writes, the ongoing fight in Amherst seems to press against every bruise that public schools have sustained in recent years. And the continued fallout, multiple investigations, resignations, a persistent vacuum in terms of leadership in the schools, does not inspire confidence in our collective capacity to work through inevitable fictions of a plural. To work through inevitable frictions of a pluralistic society, even in a liberal and affluent district, certain conflicts and tensions have come to feel irresolvable. One person I spoke to in town told me, the left is eating its own all over the country. It's not just in Amherst. So one of the allegations is some of these counselors, the non-white ones, the people of color, would occasionally bring up faith and would say that they would pray for students or asked if students had prayed about a certain issue. So that then angered, of course, some of the aggressively irreligious secular parents, especially when it comes to trans-related issues. But what's tricky is the people that they were attacking have a different skin color, and a skin color or two different skin colors that are privileged and that are often deemed unassailable in certain white progressive circles, so they weren't really sure how to go about this. There were some trans-identified kids in these classrooms in this middle school who said that they would leave class all the time because certain teachers were using the wrong pronouns, and others were saying, we were trying to get it right, it's all confusing. And so you can see some of the tensions there growing and growing and growing. Then the parents of the trans students were very angry, saying, I don't want my child ever exposed to a teacher or even a substitute teacher who mistakenly, in one case, used the wrong name and the wrong pronouns for a different non-binary student. They're like, keep that sub away from my child forever. And then the trans students' parents are talking about panic attacks and all of these things that are ruining their kids' lives. Now, we could go off on a tangent about that, a parenthetical, but I think there's probably a lot happening to those kids that are maybe contributing to a less than ideal life situation. In any case, the story explains that these trans-identifying middle school students in Amherst, Massachusetts, were being bullied for their identity. That was their claim, at least. The problem is the bullies in school, or the accused bullies, often got off scot-free with no punishment because the students were, dot, 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 black or Latino, students of color. And under the equity rubric, it's kind of unfair. With all the systemic racism, you can't really punish students of certain skin colors the same way you would maybe otherwise because of all these historic injustices. So in the name of equity, you go easy on certain kids, but what if those kids are bullying trans kids? Who wins the grievance Olympics? It's very hard to puzzle through that. And obviously this school had a lot of trouble because people were investigated constantly, complaints being lodged seemingly on a daily basis, people then getting basically kicked out, fired from school, others resigning, other people not taking positions because it was all such an ugly situation. Black staff members who were targeted with these complaints would then turn around and say, oh, you're only coming after me because I am black. Ooh, the plot thickens. And the white leftists are like, you can't say that. That's not allowed. We're on your side, but our thing, what about why? Why is this happening? Again, if there weren't kids being ruined probably in this process, it would be even funnier than it is on its face. More of these details when we come back. You want to hear how this ends on the other side.
New talk for a new generation. The Guy Benson Show.
We are back. We are mid-woke tales here on The Guy Benson Show. A New Yorker story published days ago writing about a circular firing squad of woke leftists in Amherst, Massachusetts, where it's unclear on the totem pole of identity and grievance and wokeness who wins out between transphobia concerns and racism concerns. Maybe they could bring in their senator, Elizabeth Warren, who knows a thing or two about totem poles. In any case, back to the story. According to the investigation, one of these black officials at the school frequently accused colleagues of racism and at least once engaged in retaliation against an employee who had made a complaint against a fellow staffer of color. The investigation described a culture of fear and intimidation at the school. Some staffers were frightened into silence by the fear of being labeled a racist. Quote, the worst thing you can be called in Amherst is a racist, and it keeps people stuck, one source said. Oh, imagine, isn't that frustrating? That must be very frustrating, just lashing out at anything you disagree with or any personal criticism is racist. I mean, how many people can you CC on that one? Kamala Harris, naughty Fannie Willis. I mean, the list goes on. That has been weaponized. And what's fun here is it's being weaponized against other woke leftists who happen to be white who are mad about transphobia. And they're like, no, we were saying you're transphobic. You're the bigot. You can't call us racist. And they're like, yes, we can. How dare you tell me, a person of color, that you're not racist and that I can't tell my truth? There, it just round and round it goes. Here's how the story concludes. A couple paragraphs. There's an anti-sexual harassment club at the middle school. This seems like a real piece of work, this whole community. The anti-sexual harassment middle school club brought complaints that one of their teachers at the school was commenting inappropriately in class about students' race and weight and clothing. So the district investigated, found that the claims were unsubstantiated. The teacher, who was accused, is black, who then filed a formal complaint against the club's faculty advisor, who is white, alleging that that person, quote, used her power as the advisor of the club to commit racist and sexist attacks on me. So the white person was then placed on leave, then moved to a different school. Then the teachers' union got involved, filing a grievance asking, among other things, that the sexual harassment club, the anti-sexual harassment club, just stopped meeting altogether. And the teachers' union also said there should be consequences and further education for students who have engaged in bullying of staff. And the bully targets, it seems, were the people of color in this case. So the union came in on this side, and boy, were some of the white parents and others very mad about that. There was one well-respected woman in all of this, a black woman, who refuted allegations about restorative justice circles that she had been a part of, because of course she was. Of course that was happening in this kind of district. She suggested, because people were attacking her, she had been appointed the temporary principal of the school. There was so many people leaving. There was a vacuum in leadership. This woman was highly respected, it seemed, and well-liked. They made her at least the interim principal. And then a parent, a white parent, came out and said that there had been some sort of issue on transphobia. And this parent objected to this appointment. And this caused a great stir. The community was shocked. Apparently, the transgression, pun intended, had occurred years prior and never came up. So this black woman gets up at a meeting to defend herself, and she says, yeah, I think some of these attacks are racially motivated. And she goes through and makes that allegation and says the trans stuff and the LGBTQIA. She uses almost the whole acronym. She said the justice for that community is now being weaponized. A high school staffer spoke in support of this woman and was more blunt. Quote, Amherst is racist. The staff is racist. And there's a target on the back of black people in this district. And guess what? The woman who had been offered the temporary principal job just didn't take it because it probably wasn't worth it. The screaming white woke mob against the shouting race grievance woke mob. Just going at it back and forth for months and months and months while all these kids are just trying to exist and maybe learn something. Congratulations to all involved on the progress. Doesn't it seem so enlightened? Final hour of the Guy Benson Show. Straight ahead, Andy McCarthy joins us when we return.
Raise your glass to the Guy Benson Show Happy Hour. Brought to you by the Finnish Long Drink. Finland's most popular alcoholic beverage is taking America by storm. Visit thelongdrink.com. And now, here's Guy Benson.
It's the Happy Hour on the Guy Benson Show. Thanks for listening. GuyBensonShow.com. The podcast is always free. This hour is sponsored by the Finnish Long Drink. Delicious. Alcoholic, so please drink responsibly. TheLongDrink.com. 21 plus only. Joining us now is Andy McCarthy, Fox News contributor, former federal prosecutor, best-selling author, at Andrew C. McCarthy on Twitter. Andy, great to have you back.
Guy, great to be back.
I saw this Politico story over the weekend, and it caught my attention. I thought it was interesting to see a federal judge, especially one who was appointed by Joe Biden, really ripping into the Biden DOJ, the Biden Garland DOJ. Let me just read to you from Politico. A federal judge tore into the Justice Department on Friday for blowing off Hunter Biden-related subpoenas issued in the impeachment probe of his father, President Joe Biden, pointing out that a former aide to Donald Trump is sitting in prison for similar defiance of Congress. U.S. Judge Anna Reyes, she's a district judge, a Biden appointee on the federal district court in D.C., spent nearly an hour accusing Justice Department attorneys of rank hypocrisy for instructing two other lawyers in the DOJ tax division not to comply with House subpoenas. Quote, there's a person in jail right now because you all brought a criminal lawsuit against him because he did not appear for a House subpoena, the judge said, referring to the recent imprisonment of Peter Navarro, a former Trump trade advisor, for defying a subpoena from the January 6th Select Committee. Now you guys are flouting these subpoenas and you don't have to show up? I think it's quite rich, this is the judge, that you guys pursue criminal investigations to put people in jail for not showing up, but then direct executive branch employees to take the same approach, the judge added. You all are making a bunch of arguments that you would never accept from any other litigant. Politico referred to this as a remarkable and frenetic thrashing in what was expected to be a relatively routine introductory status conference after this whole sort of standoff began. I saw some legal eagles, Andy, saying, well, she's kind of comparing apples and oranges, Navarro versus this situation with Biden, so it's not really the same. And ultimately, she didn't really punish the DOJ in accordance with her language. But still, she was obviously very unhappy with what she sees as a double standard. You can't accuse her of being a right winger. Biden appointed her. And I think to a lot of Trump supporters and people maybe on the center right, they're nodding along saying, yeah, what exactly are the rules of the road here?
Well, I think she's exactly right, Guy, and I applaud her for raising it. I think that there are people who are, you know, even if they have intense political feelings, who are not hyper-political people on the bench and in the Justice Department, who recognize that their authority comes from the perceived legitimacy of the justice system, and the perceived legitimacy of the justice system hinges on commitment to some basic foundational principles of American law, such as equal protection under the law, which is about as foundational as it gets. So I think the smarter calmer people, or I guess I should say the more prudent people in the justice system, recognize that they have an abiding interest in everybody being treated equally under the law. Because if you don't do it that way, then if the legitimacy of the system crumbles and the rule of law crumbles, then their authority crumbles. So I think it's very basic. It didn't used to be something that we'd have to argue about. I think we've talked about this before. I'm astonished. When I was a young lawyer in New York, if someone campaigned for a legal position, like an attorney general or a district attorney, promising that elect me and I'll use the powers of my office against our political enemies, that would have been disqualifying in the 1980s and 1990s. And now it's done today, and those people win office by a landslide. So I think it's a big cultural problem, and anytime somebody fights back against it, I'm happy.
In the details involved here, though, is there a meaningful difference? Because that's the pushback that I've seen. I guess in the case of Peter Navarro, this is a Trump confidant, a Trump administration member who blew off a congressional subpoena with the Select Committee on January 6th. He didn't want to comply. The DOJ then prosecuted him and put him behind bars. We have seen, for example, Hunter Biden, at least at first, refusing to comply with subpoenas. Joe Biden, his dad, had said on the Peter Navarro matter that he totally agreed that if you don't comply with a subpoena, there should be consequences. He was much quieter, of course, when it was his son that was ducking a subpoena. He eventually showed up. In this case, you have DOJ officials, apparently within the Biden administration, within that hierarchy somewhere, instructing lawyers in their realm not to comply with subpoenas from the committee that's looking into Joe Biden, the impeachment inquiry. And the Republicans argue, Andy, their testimony is really important because it goes at least to the heart of one of the matters at stake, which is Hunter Biden's income and tax avoidance and the decision to allow certain deadlines to expire on the statute of limitations, which maybe helped Biden the younger evade some of the most serious charges that could have very much landed at the doorstep of his dad. The Republicans want to hear from these DOJ career tax lawyers and get their side of the story under oath. Those lawyers are being told, no, do not comply. This judge looks at those two situations that I just laid out and says, they're analogous enough that you look like a bunch of hypocrites. Can you parse it out legally, or does that not really matter?
I actually think that Navarro is too narrow a way of looking at this guy. I think, you know, remember the Mueller investigation, remember the Ukraine impeachment, those congressional investigations. The Mueller investigation in particular, they threatened to hold Attorney General Barr in contempt for withholding from Congress elements of the Mueller report that were actually grand jury material, where there was a federal statute that basically said that you can't, and there was a decision on the D.C. Circuit that said that that material was not supposed to be shared.
Yeah, Barr was following, if I recall correctly, Barr was following literal law, and congressional Democrats were threatening to basically prosecute him for doing so.
Yes, and they also forced the issue of Don McGahn's testimony as well, the White House counsel. You know, their subpoenas, they covered the earth with subpoenas. They went crazy when the Trump Justice Department didn't comply with the subpoenas, and they didn't leave it at going crazy. When they impeached Trump over Ukraine, people don't remember this as well, but they added a second article of impeachment on the basis of obstructing Congress's investigation. So their reaction to exactly the kind of behavior that the Biden administration is engaged in now was to say that it was an impeachable offense against Biden. So I think this goes much further than Navarro, and people have very short memories about the way they conducted themselves in connection with Mueller and the other Trump-era investigations.
Yeah, I guess the Navarro example is useful because it's someone who was just recently put behind bars,
right,
kind of within the same plane. And
right,
the judge in this case, this Biden appointee, was using that example because it's maybe the most recent, which goes to
yep,
the short memory point. There's even a short memory example here, and then perhaps more egregious medium-term memory examples that I'm glad that you brought up. Here's another sort of wrangling and a wrestle match over the administration and what they're supposed to turn over and what the executive branch can or cannot withhold from Congress. Republicans, Andy, gave a deadline of noon yesterday for the DOJ or the White House to turn over, the Biden administration broadly, to turn over the tapes of the interview between Robert Hur, the special counsel, and President Biden on this classified documents question. They wanted the audio. We've gotten the transcripts, which we weren't sure we were going to get, but they wanted the audio because, obviously, at least at times, it will portray President Biden either lying or really failing memory-wise and struggling to recall some basic things. The deadline was noon. The deadline has come and gone. The Biden administration is now saying they're not going to give them up. They're fighting this. Do they have a leg to stand on? Is this something that they're going to have to produce? Are the Republicans the ones overreaching here? How do you see it?
Well, I don't see how this is privileged at all. And I think that if this was a Republican president that was withholding this, this would be like the scandal of all to end all scandals. It just seems to me, Guy, that, you know, President Clinton's grand jury testimony that became public, not just the transcript of it, but the video of it. When President Trump
was that just to refresh my memory, and this is much longer term for me, was that when he was squabbling over the definition of the word is, was that from that testimony that was on video?
That's correct. It was okay. A grand jury. President Clinton agreed, in lieu of appearing before the grand jury, to sit down for an interview under oath, I believe, with the special prosecutor. At the time, it was called independent counsel, Ken Starr's staff. And that tape became public. And there was no way that it wouldn't have become public, even though it was very embarrassing for Clinton. And it was in terms of his approval polls and the like, it was not a good thing for him politically, but they didn't really have a leg to stand on to say that they wouldn't turn it over. It wasn't privileged. It was, you know, it was grand jury testimony. President Trump had to turn over his interrogatories. They made those public in connection with the Mueller investigation. Now, he didn't sit down for an interview, but he did agree to answer questions. And I think if the Barr-led Justice Department had tried to withhold that and not turn it over again, that would have been, scandalous at the time.
So what do they argue? If the Republicans are saying, we want the video, there's recordings of Biden talking to the special counsel. Special counsel didn't charge Biden for his obvious illegal acts. I think it's just, open and shut. He broke the law with the classified documents. And this is willful. The special counsel says this openly, something that the White House subsequently lied about. But in his testimony, he made very clear this was a willful breaking of the law. But he wrote famously in his report that he didn't think that a jury would convict an old, confused man with memory lapses and mental acuity problems. That was kind of the off-ramp here, the escape hatch. Democrats were mad about that. Then they tried to withhold the transcripts. We got those. The recordings exist. What is their legal argument to withhold this from Congress? And I assume a legal argument that's viable cannot just be this would cause political pain in a re-election year.
Yeah, they really don't have a legal argument. I mean, they're just basically they think they can tough it out. And they've decided, they've made a calculation, that the political damage they sustain from taking the stonewalling position, even though there is real political damage from doing that, is less damaging than would be turning over the tape, which apparently would be a catastrophe for them. So I understand why they're doing it, but, their only leg to stand on is that they can.
Isn't it risky, though? Because, Andy, let's say they take some slings and arrows for a while, not a ton of pressure from the press, because the press is on their side, but let's say the Republicans challenge this, and it gets expedited in court, and then they have to turn over the video anyway, and the video makes Biden look just old and bewildered, and that goes public, and we have multiple news cycles talking about it. Then they get beat up for the stonewalling, and then the video comes out anyway, closer to the election. Are they just thinking they can hopefully wait this thing out past the election?
Yeah, I think, Guy, that they don't always think the way, we're trying to plot it out and play it out how it would work with the calendar. They're trying to get through Tuesday. I don't think that they have a long-term strategy. I think that they think if they tough it out, they have the media support, and it won't be as damaging. They're not saying it won't be damaging at all, but, they're trying to tough it out. I agree with you. I think that eventually they're probably going to have to turn the tape over. You know, the fact that you mentioned that they go to court, you know, they can defy a court the same way that they can defy Congress. Nobody can make the executive branch. The executive branch is the law enforcement arm of the government. So it's not like the Congress can prosecute them or the court can prosecute them. So depending on how disastrously bad they think it would be to release this tape, they could defy a court that told them to turn it over. But, you know,
yeah, just say, oh, we're going to keep appealing and then drag that out. I don't think they could probably get away with just straight up saying, all right, we see the order from the court and we say no. They would find some way to kind of kick the can, at least rhetorically. Changing gears, Andy, a significant announcement yesterday from Donald Trump on the abortion issue. I want to get your analysis on the other side of this break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
A fresh perspective on the topics of the day. It's Guy Benson.
Back on the Guy Benson Show, Andy McCarthy kind enough to stick around. Andy, quickly, I do want to get your reaction to the former president's abortion policy announcement yesterday from a political standpoint, from a legal standpoint as well, constitutionally. What do you make of it?
Well, I think that, you know, as far as Trump is concerned, I've never really thought, I think he's as transactional on abortion as he is on everything else. I never thought he was a committed pro-lifer. And I think he made a political calculation, which is kind of the comfortable political calculation for Republicans who don't want to talk about this, that, you know, it's a matter for the states. To my mind, it's a shame that they haven't learned how to make the argument in the states that turns the tables on the Democrats' position, which is very extreme on abortion. But I think that's the reason he did it. As a matter of constitutional law, I think I'm in a minority on this, but, you know, I believed what we were saying when for 40 years, the conservative movement and the pro-life movement, when they were in court, they argued that this was a state matter and that the court ought to get out of it and send it back to the states. That was Justice Scalia's position. I always thought it was right. I don't think that because you win in Dobbs, you know, you can suddenly start squinting at the 14th Amendment and the Equal Protection Clause and the Due Process Clause and whatever other theory and say, you know what? It turns out that the Constitution does speak to this issue.
Right.
I think this is a state law issue. And I also think for Republicans who want to do this at the national level, when we're usually fighting things that should be state law stuff to get it decided at the national level, they ought to be careful what they wish for, because if this gets decided at a national level, it's going to be a ban that would allow probably about 98% of abortions.
At least what's being discussed right now. So that's a very interesting angle on it, Andy. I would say on how Republicans fight the battle poorly, and I agree with you, often that is the case. Part of the problem isn't their fault. Some of it is. But part of it is also, going back to the media and the conversation we were having earlier, the press is on the Democrats' side on this. The press is to the left of the Democrats and have dragged the Democrats in that direction along with the activist class. And so they do a lot of cover for the Dems. I mean, Joe Biden, for much of his career, was moderate on abortion, for the Hyde Amendment banning taxpayer money on abortion, against late-term abortion. He was even critical of the constitutionality of Roe v. Wade. Now he's for abortion on demand through 9 months, a massive change. He's abandoned the Hyde Amendment, and you almost never see scrutiny of that because the press agrees with his new position. So they're rewarding him for that. They're rewarding him for being bullied by them, and they're covering for him as a result. But we will get lots of think pieces about how Trump has changed on abortion, which is also true, but you often see discrepancies in how the two political parties are covered. It's like part one zillion of the press bias files, but they are probably worst. On all the issues on the waterfront, abortion might be the worst in terms of bias, and I had to underscore that. Andy McCarthy, our guest on the Guy Benson Show. Andy, as always, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Guy.
And we'll be right back.
Not the same talking points here. The Guy Benson Show.
KT McFarland has served under four different presidential administrations. She was our guest on the Guy Benson Show back in our first hour. Here's part of our conversation, of course, foreign policy focus with KT McFarland. From an America First perspective, KT, why is the Israeli alliance really crucial to us on our side?
Well, it's for what we stand for. It's Israel's a democracy. But frankly, Israel's keeping peace in the Middle East, you know, in a weird way. Why? Why do I say that? Because if Israel ceased to exist, disappeared tomorrow off the face of the earth, well, who's in charge of the Middle East? Iran is in charge of the Middle East. Iran, who the Biden administration has enriched because of Biden's policies, not only of pandering to Iran, but not enforcing the sanctions. He's allowing Iran to sell oil. Trump didn't allow them to sell oil. Biden has arranged for Iran to have billions of dollars worth of revenues that Trump had frozen. And then particularly because of Biden's energy policies, which drives the price of oil sky high, that enriches Iran. Iran, what is Iran doing with this probably $100 billion that Biden has let them have? They're making war. And they're not going to stop until they control the entire Middle East. So from an America First, what's in it for us? How are we affected? I think American national security is in danger if you have Iran in the Middle East, in charge of the Middle East, and a nuclear Iran in the Middle East. So in a roundabout way, now maybe it's not Iran isn't going to fire those missiles at the United States, but anybody who's chanting death to America, you know, believe dictators. One thing I've learned in 50 years in this line of work, don't believe politicians. They'll tell you anything, right? They need to get elected. Look at Joe Biden. Believe the dictators because they don't care about public opinion. They're telling you right straight to your face what they're intending to do. And death to America is Iran's policy.
Yeah, that's such an important point. I would also note on that point, the Israelis have done so much militarily, but also through intelligence and some really dramatic intelligence coups. They've been able to set back the Iranian regime and their nuclear program on numerous occasions, stealing a bunch of their documents in a brazen, amazing raid that they pulled off. The Stuxnet bug that they were able to use to infect the nuclear program in Iran, some certain bombings, and there was, of course, a targeted strike against an Iranian leader in Syria not long ago. Was that last week? The Israelis, maybe that's a roundabout way of saying the Israelis do some of the really tough, sort of dirty hands stuff that the U.S. doesn't want to. They do a lot of intelligence sharing with us. That's another big, big, big plus for the U.S. and vice versa. And we say, hey, Israel, here's some intelligence from our end. That looks like a threat to us and probably to you. I wish someone could do something about that. And often it's the Israelis doing it. So it's not us and our people and our boots. If I'm not mistaken, KT, that's at least part of my characterization, augmenting your explanation of why I think people underestimate the Israeli side of this alliance at their peril.
Israel is helping the United States because Israel, at least prior to what's happening now, was keeping the peace in the Middle East.
My full discussion with KT McFarland, former Deputy National Security Advisor under President Trump, available at GuyBensonShow.com. Part of that free podcast. It's every day. It's always on demand. It is always free of charge. GuyBensonShow.com, FoxNewsPodcast.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. When we come back, a bit of a scene, a bit of a rumble at the old Hibachi Grill. Producer Christine had quite an interesting vacation. We'll give you that detail that we teased yesterday when we come back.
Same issues, but with a fresh perspective. The Guy Benson Show.
Homestretch, Guy Benson Show, Tuesday edition. Thanks for tuning in. Podcast is free, on demand, every day, GuyBensonShow.com. So we had the triumphant return of Cookie to the show yesterday. She was out there doing Eclipse Watch for us. Then, really, just an instant classic of a home stretch. That one went mostly off the rails very quickly. We had an intern in the studio who was looking around like, what have I gotten myself into? It's a good question for her. But one of the things that we didn't quite flesh out was this vague reference to something of a confrontation at a Hibachi Grill involving Judgy Joyce, Christine's mother, and separately but relatedly, Christine was saying that she believes that in her previous lives – she must have endured some sort of trauma that makes her irrational, and many people are saying crazy, especially under any sort of stress. And my argument was, maybe we shouldn't look to previous lives. Not something that I believe in. I think Christine might want to have a chat with her priest at her Catholic church on what their doctrine is on that question. Just a suggestion. We could just look at Christine's own current lifetime. And I think one of the explanatory factors here, a big one, might be the influence of Judge E. Joyce. We were treated recently to a story about Judge E. Joyce having quite a blow up at a little tangle over a stop sign, and the police came and she was shouting at the cop, if I recall correctly. Well, it seems like this Frank Costanza level temperament spilled over as well at a recent family dinner at a hibachi grill. And my very first question, Christine, is why were you out to dinner at a hibachi grill? Am I not mistaken that Bobby is a hibachi chef, your husband? Doesn't he do this stuff himself?
He sure does. We call it hibachi.
Hibachi, that's right. And you were very proud of that.
He was great.
So why are you going to pay other people for the hibachi skills that you have right under your own roof?
Well, the stovetop grill that we had in the on Isor Lane, we wound up giving it to the new homeowners because we were moving into an apartment and we weren't allowed to bring it.
Oh, so the whole setup.
So there's no
remains.
Yeah, we need the achi part of hibachi.
Yeah, you only have Bob. You only have hubbub.
Yeah,
and you have no. Yeah, and, I got it.
Yeah. So, Bob, turn the radio off right now. I think that's going to be his Father's Day present. I can name some brands if they want to sponsor us for Father's Day.
Well, I wouldn't name the brands. I would just throw that out there and see if any of the brands contact you.
At Cookies Jar, 1988.
At Cookies Jar, 1988. If the brands, the hibachi brands, want to contact Cookie, they can do so on Twitter/X. All right, so that explanation makes sense. You guys had a hankering for not just the meal, but the show of hibachi. You've got the old trick with the onion that becomes a volcano. You've got the whole flipping around little pieces of beef and shrimp into the hat of the chef or even directly into the mouth of the diner, although that always worries me about a choking hazard, but it's all in good fun until it isn't. So the family is gathered round the old grill, and you've got the guy doing all the tapping, all the sounds with the knives and the spatulas and all of that and the sizzle, and then things went south.
Right, so Bobby was down with the stomach flu. So unfortunately, on Megan's birthday, he couldn't even come to the dinner.
Oh, no Bob at hibachi at
no,
all.
No. So it was little Megan, Cookie, and Judge E. Joyce. And sometimes she's not always the nicest at dining establishments if she doesn't have it her way. Actually, she yelled at a person in Burger King and mortified Megan because I guess she didn't get her sweet and sour sauce quick enough. And Megan was like, Mom, I can't go with her anymore because she just yells at people.
Well, I mean, in fairness, the actual slogan at Burger King is have it your way.
Oh, right, that's true.
So I feel like if Joyce is going to jump down someone's throat and be judgy, wanting it her exact way, it would be at the place where the slogan for decades has been that she can. All right, so maybe she expands that lesson and applies it out too broadly within the, I don't know, the hospitality industry. And what was the source of her frustration this time?
So the guy was doing all of his tricks. He also, don't forget, he makes the snowman with the white rice.
I haven't had the snowman.
Oh, yeah, and then he sings, "Do you want to build a snowman?" This guy, he was great. My favorite, I couldn't partake because I was driving since Bobby wasn't with me, but he has like a little squeeze bottle and in it is sake and he squeezes it into your mouth and you can like raise your hand and ask for more.
Oh, I'm amazed that you were able to turn that down.
Yes. No drinking. So he's going around the table and he's doing his little tricks, and then he decides he's taking, you know, cut up vegetables, very tiny ones, and he's throwing it. So he throws it to Megan's friend, he throws it to Megan, he throws it to me. And
is he like throwing it into your mouth?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. No, I'm just going to say this. I'm usually on the first try, too. I'm pretty good. Megan and her friend, they just stunk at it. So then we get to...
I love just the gratuitous shot at the children.
Take that, kids.
For not catching the carrot on the first try.
No, the first try, they couldn't catch it on the second try, the third try. It never happened. They didn't catch it. So anyway.
Oh, so no. Judgy Joyce
Am
is probably,
I Judgy Cookie?
Yeah, you are. I mean, you are Judgy's daughter. The apple has fallen directly underneath the tree.
Well, the whole time, my mom's like waving her arm saying, no, no, no. I guess that meant she didn't want it, but she wasn't really saying that. She's just like waving her arms.
Yeah, use your words.
Right. Well, the guy chucks it, not chucks it, but throws it up to catch, and it hits my mom in the face. And then he goes again, hits my mom in like the nose. And then by the third time, she just grabs it in her hand, looks at it, picks it up, chucks it. Right back at him, like at his face.
She threw the food.
Threw the food right at him.
At the cook.
She was so angry. She's like, I told you no.
Now, did he catch it in his mouth?
He did not.
Wow.
It kind of like went silent. It kind of went quiet for a second. And then the other people, because you're with other families.
Right. It's not just private.
No. And Megan was like, oh my gosh. And then he kept going around the table and, we all just sat there. I'm like, Mom, you shouldn't have done that.
So there was a record scratch where everyone's just like, oh, we found the skunk at the garden party.
Yeah. And it's like, you know what happens after
And what hibachi. Did she say? Did she feel – yeah, it's like, you know what you're signing up for. This is not her first hibachi rodeo?
No.
So was she at all – I don't know, regretful of this? Did she
– No, she lives her life with no regrets. No apologies, no regrets. She is who she is. And it's just, as my therapist has once said, you ain't going to change her at this age. So you just got to deal. And that's when
Does she say that about you or about your mother?
Oh, my. No.
Both.
I can change by, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I'm maturing.
Cookie's real, really adaptive. That's what I think of with Cookie. Okay, so there's no contrition from Joyce. She has just thrown food back at the hibachi chef. Do you guys just sort of awkwardly finish your meal and shuffle out of there? Like, how do you come back from that?
Well, we all kind of get quiet, and then you would think she would maybe break the ice with something light. It is Megan's birthday, but no, she goes right into, how my great aunt's in the hospital dying and needs all these surgeries, and there's a cancer and this, then that. And I'm like, oh my gosh, Mom, this is a birthday celebration. We're
like
not celebrating.
Rachel Dratch's character, Debbie Downer.
Yes, that's exactly. Yes, me and Bobby say that all the time. She's Debbie Downer.
Okay, so all of this being said...
She's going to kill me.
Do you maybe understand why you don't have to call back to previous lives that you claim you have to maybe explain some of the ways you are?
Oh, was that what you meant yesterday?
Yes.
Oh, you're saying that my anxiety and like the way I'm like kind of a little cray-cray...
Let's say, yeah, you're... eccentricities. Let's be nice.
But she doesn't have that. Doesn't have that hysterical.
No, but I think, correct, you haven't inherited it from her. It has manifested because of her.
Huh. I think we would have to talk to somebody else about that.
A professional, perhaps?
Yeah,
not a psychic?
Well, listen.
No, that's not a psychic thing. Actual therapist thing.
It's been years now of me trying to push psychic, and it's not a joke. This isn't like
But the psychic would not be – that's not even in the realm of things that psychics make up. Therapy is what you need.
I've been doing it for years.
And no one has ever told you that perhaps some of these issues derive from a root cause known as Judgy Joyce that's never come up? How much are you paying these people?
Well,
it's like the most obvious thing ever. As your unlicensed, uncompensated therapist to me over many years, we have a clear – I'm not going to call her a culprit because I think in many ways I side with her in some of these battles that you guys have. But, I mean, let's be honest.
So you're saying her actions are a direct correlation to my psycho craziness. We won't say psycho. Right, Justin? I'm not like psycho.
Psycho feels a bit harsh.
Thanks. Thank you.
Yeah, he's new.
Slightly.
He's new. So – But yes,
oh boy.
The answer is yes. Now, before we go, because yesterday you were all over the place in the home stretch, you also were trying to tell us earlier in the show that you were convinced that the eclipse, the predicted forever eclipse, was somehow caused by or related to the earthquake or vice versa, which is just not how science works at all. Your mother-in-law, so Hababshi's mother, was listening to the home stretch yesterday, and she weighed in on this.
Hi, Kathy. The exact text was, just listen to all of that. You're a nut job.
And how do you respond to that from your mother-in-law?
I mean, I am your granddaughter's mother.
Does that concern her?
How does that feel? No, she does drink a lot of wine when she comes to our house when she visits.
Okay. So I guess she's...
Maybe she's worried.
She's like, you're her little nut job. Like, she likes it. She's a fan.
All right. I'll take that. I will.
Okay.
I do wonder around here. You know, I was talking to Justin today about a couple emails I sent down. And a lot. I feel like this week alone, a lot. Maybe we could do another home stretch. I feel like people are not reading my emails correctly. And it's happening a lot. Hmm. And like Justin's like, well, you know, sometimes maybe you look at yourself when more than one time it happens. But I looked at Justin and I'm like, am I just the girl that can't find the sun to you all? Is that all I am?
It seems like there is a recent Taylor Swift lyric that we have applied to you before that might once again crop up in this context when you are trying to identify the source of a problem and at some point you realize the source of the problem and you just own up to it and you realize who it is.
Well, I do that. I have learned that from therapy.
And so what would you sing, for example, as you look at all of these issues in your life?
It's me.
Mm-hmm.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm the problem. It's me.
There we go.
Are we done for today?
We are, but I'm just going to say one thing. I'm going to leave you in an unexpected way.
But I have to talk about the new hot priest. You told me to.
I did not. I am hearing about the new hot priest for the first time right now. Let's put that on the back burner of the Hababshi grill, and we can return to Hot Priest. This is Hot Priest 2.0? This
yes!
is not the same guy?
Yes!
It's
and,
another
and
one?
And the first one's there now, too.
Oh, there's both
I forgot
of them.
To tell you that during, remember Megan's Passion, her
yeah,
Easter?
Yeah, I do. And I was just recommending that you go to Mass more often.
I know!
Based on your, I think, misunderstanding of Catholic doctrine with the whole previous lives thing, now you have two more reasons, apparently, to go to church more often. The last thing I'm going to say, Christine, is on the emails, the one email that I know you're referencing, at least one of them, I'm with you. I think that was a clear email, and the other person read it wrong. You were not the problem in that one specific case, but you almost always are. Out of time on The Guy Benson Show. Back here tomorrow, same time, same place. We'll talk to you then.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. In these ever-changing times, you can rely on Fox News for hourly updates for the very latest news and information on your time. Listen and download now at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.